and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the rampant hypocrisy on display on Capitol Hill as House Republicans and some Democrats fulminate with indignation against one of only three Muslim members of the House, accusing Representative Ilhan Omar of anti-Semitism and racism and being a national security threat while comparing her to 9/11 terrorists. Meanwhile, the racist-in-chief in the Oval Office is apparently free to praise neo-Nazis, hurl obscenities at Africans, dehumanize Muslims, and smear Mexicans as rapists and murderers. Amir Tibon, the Washington correspondent for Israel's Haaretz and the co-author of The Last Palestinian, joins us to discuss his latest article at Haaretz. Ocasio-Cortez defends Ilhan Omar as anti-Semitism storm roils Democratic Party. We will discuss how the Republicans are trying to drive a wedge into the Democratic caucus, pitting the new crop of progressives against the older pro-Israel lawmakers who were quick to circulate a resolution condemning Congresswoman Omar for suggesting that pro-Israel activists were pushing, quote, for allegiance to a foreign country. This prompted a backlash from the Congressional Black Caucus and other Democrats who complained of a double standard when bigoted comments by the president and Republicans go unchallenged, arguing that Islamophobia needs to be included for condemnation along with anti-Semitism. Then we'll speak with Jonathan Metzl, professor of sociology and psychiatry at Vanderbilt University and director of its Center for Medicine, Health and Society, about his new book, just out, Dying of Whiteness: How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland. We will discuss the documented evidence that across the South and the Midwest, supporters of Donald Trump, who have swallowed the Republican dogma against Obamacare, Medicaid expansion, and gun control in a backlash against governance itself, are literally dying as a result of the policies put in place by the politicians they support. Then finally, we'll get an update on the expanding number of investigations into Trump, his family, and his administration, and speak with Lawrence Douglas, a professor of law, jurisprudence, and social thought at Amherst College. He joins us to discuss the significance of Michael Cohen providing the House Intelligence Committee with proof his testimony was altered by White House lawyers, and speculation by the former head of the CIA that grand jury indictments will be unveiled on Friday by Robert Mueller. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Amir Tibon, who is the Washington, D.C. correspondent for Haaretz. He is the co-author of The Last Palestinian, a book about Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. And his latest article at Haaretz is Ocasio-Cortez defends Ilhan Omar as anti-Semitism storm roils Democratic Party. Welcome to Background Briefing, Amir Tibon.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And I'm interested in how the public in Israel sees what's going on Capitol Hill, where you've got the Republicans trying to sort of use a wedge issue against the Democrats, suggesting that the Democrats aren't sufficiently pro-Israel, while many Democrats are in fact beating up on their own, if you will, helping the Republicans divide and conquer. It's obviously got Nancy Pelosi worried. They've got an ambitious agenda, and it does feel like they're being sidetracked. So again, this country of Israel seems to really get so much attention on Capitol Hill. As an Israeli, do you find it a little bit disproportionate?
So first of all, you asked me how this is being viewed in Israel. And the truth is, this story is making a lot more headlines in the U.S. and specifically in Washington than it is in Israel, mainly because in Israel we have an election going on right now. We've got our own political dramas. There are polls coming every day and the parties are making statements. And we just had the prime minister go through a legal, the beginning of an indictment process last week. So Ilhan Omar is not making a lot of headlines in Israel. With regards to the second question of the proportion of the coverage and the the focus on Israel and Capitol Hill. I think on the one hand, it's true that Israel, for a small country so far away from the U.S., is getting a lot of attention. On the other hand, you know, there was also a poll released today by Gallup about public attentions of the American public towards Israel and the Palestinians. And you see that this is an issue that a lot of Americans have an opinion about. Israel specifically is very popular with the American public. And so I think that also reflects part of the attention that on the one hand, it is a small country far, far away from Washington. On the other hand, many people in the U.S., whether it's the Jewish community, evangelical Christians, the Muslim community, and many other Americans do care and feel about this issue. And I think that's why it keeps coming up in the headlines time after time.
But in this case, it seems that pro-Israel sentiment is being weaponized by the Republicans, and it's putting the Democrats in a situation where they're sort of saying, but, you know, we're the Me Too party. You know, I mean, my understanding is that the Democratic Party has its record, I think, of loyalty to Israel is pretty unassailable, isn't it?
So for many years, it's true, most of the decades ever since Israel was founded, the Democrats were considered the more pro-Israeli party. I think it had to do with the fact that the vast majority of American Jews vote for the Democratic Party, including in the last presidential election and in the last midterm elections. Around 70 or more percent of the Jewish population voted for the Democrats, and that certainly had an impact. But this identification of the Democrats as the party that is more supportive of Israel, it is eroding and changing over the past two decades, I would say, and especially at an accelerated pace during the last 10 years when we've seen a right-wing prime minister in Israel, Netanyahu, have a consistent clash with a Democratic president in Washington, Obama, and then have some kind of a bromance, some people describe it that way, with the current president, with Trump, who is very unpopular on the Democratic side. And that has contributed to a deterioration. And I think today in the Democratic Party, you really have a divide on attitudes towards Israel. I think most Democrats still, the majority of the elected officials of the party in Washington, are supportive of Israel and they want to have a good relationship with Israel, even if they have criticism of Netanyahu's government and his policies. But you also have a wing that is much more critical, and I think Ilhan Omar is a prime representative of that part of the Democratic Party, that takes a much harsher attitude of criticism towards Israel, and specifically in the last few cases also made statements about Israel's supporters in the United States that many people in the Jewish community considered anti-Semitic, or at least having anti-Semitic tone to it, and that's what is causing this eruption. So the Democrats are, I would say, divided on this issue. It's not like 20 or 30 years ago when the vast majority of the party was in one position on the Israeli issue.
Well, some of the criticism, though, of Representative Omar, particularly coming from Steve Scalise, suggesting that she's, he didn't say she's un-American, but he said that effectively that she shouldn't have a security clearance, questioned whether she should have a security clearance. And I think in West Virginia, representatives also likened her to 9/11 terrorists. It seems fairly heated. You know, there are only three Muslim representatives in the U.S. House. And when you talk about how things have changed, attitudes have changed over the decades in lessening support for Israel in the Democratic Party, is it also generational? These congresspeople, particularly the ones that are being singled out, and certainly Ocasio-Cortez, she's the youngest, by the way, so is there something going on there in terms of a generational shift? And if so, Israelis surely should be worried about that.
So first of all, about some of the Republican comments, obviously, if you're asking for my personal opinion, I did not like what she said, and I think that she deserves criticism, but just like she has a right to criticize Israel without using, you know, language that I think is exaggerated and hurtful, I also don't think that her critics should compare her to terrorists. Okay, I mean, there is we need to have a rational discussion about this, and without using any kind of racist or anti-Semitic language on, you know, on either side. So that's just my personal view, and that's why I'm not really going to comment on some of these stupid comments that were directed at her. With regards to the generational question, I think that is at the heart of the issue. We see in public opinion polling in the United States that Israel still enjoys the support or the sympathy of the majority of Americans, and most Americans have a positive view of Israel. But as you go down the age groups in the polling numbers, you do see a change in how younger people view Israel. And that is true across all, or I wouldn't say all, but many demographic groups, the Jewish community, the evangelical community. You know, these were the two communities that were most supportive of Israel over the years. And you see that even over there, younger people are less supportive of Israel than the generation of 20 and 30 years ago. And that definitely does raise concern in Israel. But the problem is that Israeli politicians, much like American politicians, most of them think about tomorrow, about getting elected in the next election, about the next headline that will be about them in the newspaper. And they don't pay too much attention to trends that will impact the life of the citizens of Israel 15, 20, 30 years from now, like what kind of support will they have in the United States. And that's why this real problem, this real challenge that Israel has with younger Americans, and especially people on the Democratic side, is not being treated very well right now by the Israeli government.
And again, I'm speaking with Amir Tibon, who is the Washington, D.C. correspondent for Haaretz. He is the author of The Last Palestinian, a book about Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. And his latest article at Haaretz is Ocasio-Cortez Defends Ilhan Omar as Anti-Semitism Storm Roils Democratic Party. So April the 9th, I believe, is the election in Israel. How much is Netanyahu's... I wouldn't call it a drift to the right. It seems like a huge sort of lurch to the right, embracing the party that was inspired by Rabbi Kahana. I guess it's the reincarnation of the Kach party, right? Well, that was his party, right?
So basically what Netanyahu did, he signed some kind of a political pact with the most, I would say, the most far-right party in Israeli politics. And it's true, this is a party that was inspired by the racist and the terror supporting Rabbi Meir Kahane. And at the time, I would call it an earlier version of this party, was banned by the Israeli Supreme Court and by the Knesset. And Netanyahu, because he's very concerned about the right-wing vote splintering in the upcoming election, decided to encourage a different right-wing party that I would call less extreme, to take these very, very racist and extremist activists and put them under its wings. And he received a lot of criticism for it, both in Israel and in the United States, even from some of the most pro-Israeli organizations in the Jewish community, because this is really an unusual step for an Israeli prime minister. In the past, the right-wing parties in Israel, including Likud, Netanyahu's own party, they rejected the hatred and the racism of Kahane and of this very far-right stream in politics. And personally, I will share my own opinion. I thought it was a sad day for our country when the prime minister, instead of rejecting the kind of hatred, decided to embrace it. And the reason he did it is because he thinks it will help him electorally on April 9th.
Well, you mentioned the objection across the board, particularly here in the United States, to this move by Netanyahu. AIPAC was also critical of him. And aren't they hosting him before the elections? Won't Netanyahu be out here, I guess, what, in a few weeks?
Yes. With AIPAC, it was, I would call it, a very delicate dance. AIPAC has a policy that they never comment on internal Israeli politics. They don't take positions on that. They support the Israeli government no matter what. I personally have my own opinion about that, but if we stick to the facts of what happened, they released a very rare and unusual statement 2 weeks ago denouncing the far-right party, the Jewish Power Party, as they call themselves. And they put out a statement that they boycott this party, AIPAC, I mean. They don't meet with its representatives, that it's an abhorrent party. And this was seen and interpreted by the media, both in the U.S. and in Israel, as a rebuke of Netanyahu, even though he was not mentioned by name. And the reason it was interpreted in such a way is because of how rare and how unusual it is for AIPAC to ever comment on internal Israeli politics. And also, what they did, they quoted a statement by another Jewish organization, the American Jewish Committee, that is also usually supportive of Israel, which said in the past, these kinds of fringe and extremist ideas were rejected by the large parties in Israel, which is, you know, it's a hint that today that's not the situation. However, a short time after that statement came out, they also announced that Netanyahu will speak at the annual AIPAC conference in Washington, D.C., and he's not the only Israeli politician. You will have the heads of other parties as well. And that didn't surprise me, because I think from AIPAC's point of view, they did such a huge step just by criticizing that move, that they almost, you know, kind of, it was almost expected that they would compensate and say, well, Netanyahu is still invited. And I think the really interesting question will be, how will the other part of the American Jewish community receive Netanyahu during his visit to Washington? And will the protest that we saw 2 weeks ago over this agreement with the far-right party, will it have any echoes when he actually comes to the United States? You know, we'll wait and see, I guess.
But do you think, though, that these tactics on the part of the Republicans now to sort of divide the Democrats, and obviously there was a pretty feisty Democratic caucus meeting because a couple of the long-serving members of the House sort of joined in, the Republicans, and there was a resolution to condemn Ilhan Omar, which the Congressional Black Caucus objected, etc. So in terms of dividing, obviously, there's a both. They it seems like the Democrats are falling into the Republican trap at the same time, shooting themselves in the foot a little bit. But in general, there seems to be a lot of, and it comes largely from, it seems, from Netanyahu, the idea that, you know, this kind of my way or the highway attitude is, if you don't agree with us, you're somehow anti-Semitic. That's an equal and opposite trope, if you will. And it's also, in many ways, made its way into these arguments on campus about BDS, etc. Do you think that that attitude amongst a lot of right-wing Israelis and supporters of Israel on the right here in the United States is backfiring and perhaps is contributing in some way to why younger Americans, their support for Israel is waning?
So I think, first of all, with regards to what's happening to the Democrats on Capitol Hill, at the end of the day, members of the party, especially on the House, but you know, to some extent also in the Senate, they think not only about the party as an institution, but also about their districts and their voters. And if you look at who are the members who commented against Ilhan Omar's comments, I think you would not be surprised to see that most of them would come from more suburban, not all of them, but most of them more suburban or rural parts of the country where you do have a lot of support for Israel. And these comments are not necessarily supported by a lot of people. And the same would go for members who have significant Jewish population or evangelical population in their district. So I understand the idea that, you know, is the party united or not, but also the representatives think about their own people that they support. With regards to the BDS issue and the Israeli right wing, I do think that there is some kind of a symbiotic relationship between BDS and its few supporters in Congress, like Ilhan Omar and Representative Rashida Tlaib from Michigan, and the Israeli right wing, that they kind of build each other. And you know, every time that there's a statement like this, you would see a lot of the Israeli right wing, and then its supporters in the U.S. capitalize on it and make it stronger. And of course, this plays also into the hands of the politicians who are making those comments. If you look at, you know, at what has been going on in Washington ever since the midterms, the Democrats elected a lot of new, I would say, center-left members of Congress, people with national security background, people who served in the military. A lot of them won in Republican districts. They flipped places that the Democrats had not had representation in for, you know, a decade or more. You barely hear about those candidates anymore. But Ilhan Omar, who represents a solid Democratic urban district in Minnesota, gets huge headlines all the time because of these clashes with, you know, the Israel, the pro-Israel lobby and the right-wing organizations. And so, you know, is this good for the Democrats in any way? I'm not sure. But what is happening, it's definitely good for the organizations that are denouncing her and bidding on her, and also good for her because, you know, politicians want to be in the spotlight at the end of the day. And we just spent 15 minutes talking about it, so I guess we're part of the phenomenon as well.
Right. But do you think, though, that there is a kind of attitude with the more aggressively pro-Israel people that it's my way or the highway, and that to some extent that might contribute to this backlash that's happening?
I think it's definitely true that some people would like to paint any criticisms of the Israeli government as illegitimate. I don't think that's the case. But, you know, this is a personal opinion. I don't think that's the case here. I think a lot of people who are critical of the Israeli government and who oppose the settlement are also offended by what she said and are also denouncing her. So I wouldn't say that she's only being criticized by supporters of Netanyahu and the settlement. That's not true. But I think it is a mistake. You know, if we're not talking specifically about Ilhan Omar, but if we're talking about the broader phenomenon, it is a mistake for Israel and supporters of Israel to look at any criticism as anti-Israeli or even anti-Semitic. There is a place for rational debate about the occupation and about settlement and about the Palestinians. These are issues that have to be discussed. And it's fair to ask that the discussion won't include saying that, you know, support for Israel in America is all about money, which is not true, because a lot of Americans support Israel for religious, ideological, geostrategic reasons. Does that mean they also have to support the settlement and the occupation? I think not. But it doesn't mean that their support is because of money. So it is a complicated discussion. And I'm against the idea that just raising these questions is somehow being anti-Israel. That's something I personally don't accept.
Well, just in closing, Amir Tiberon, you mentioned the centrists in the Democratic Party that were elected in purple districts or previously red districts, and that's pretty much what seems to be happening now in Israel. Those are arrayed against Netanyahu, and as we mentioned, he's sort of moving further to the right. And will that help this coalition of the former IDF chief of staff and Lapid, who was a centrist? Is there any evidence that there's going to be a backlash? In other words, the center-right in Israel may migrate somewhat to the left?
That's, I think, the biggest question of the election. We have the main party challenging Netanyahu right now is a centrist. I would even call them center-right, but that's only because I define myself as left-wing. So, you know, I guess it depends who you're asking. But from my point of view, a center-right party that is trying to challenge Netanyahu. And I would compare it a little bit to, yes, you have some elements of it that you could compare to centrist Democrats in the U.S. Some of it you could compare to Republicans who are never Trump, who decided to defect from the Republican Party and said they cannot be associated with Trump anymore. It's basically a kind of a ragtag coalition of people who say, you know, we want to change the way Netanyahu runs the country. Not necessarily the policies, but definitely the politics. And the politics of Netanyahu are politics of incitement and corruption and spreading hate between the different population groups in Israel, Jews and Arabs, right-wing and left-wing, people from different ethnic backgrounds. And they offer to change that and to bring a more respectful and open discussion to the country. I don't know yet if it will succeed. We have more than a month until the elections. We are seeing in Israel right now phenomena that would be very recognizable to Americans from the 2016 election. A lot of fake news, a lot of just completely bogus and untrue stories that are making the rounds on the internet. And for some reason, the vast majority of them are aimed at the leaders of the centrist coalition challenging Netanyahu. The polls show a very, very tight race, and I do agree that if this coalition will succeed, we could perhaps see it replicated in other countries as well, where the far right has had gains over the years. The left is not so sure how to strike back, and maybe there is an opening on the center. I don't think that's true of the United States. You have a two-party system here. It's totally different, but maybe in some European countries and others, this could be relevant.
Well, Amir Tiberon, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you again. And I've been speaking with Amir Tiberon, who's the Washington, D.C. correspondent for Haaretz. He is the co-author of The Last Palestinian, a book about Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. And his latest article at Haaretz is Ocasio-Cortez Defends Ilhan Omar as Anti-Semitism Storm Roils Democratic Party. We're going to take a brief station break and back, looking into how across the South and Midwest, supporters of Donald Trump have swallowed the Republican dogma against Obamacare, Medicaid expansion, and gun control, and are literally dying as a result of the policies put in place by the politicians they support.
All we are saying is give these a chance. what's can they explain? And the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain as he rises to fame. And the poor white remains on the caboose of the train, but it ain't him to blame, he's only a pawn in our game.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Jonathan Metzl, who's the Frederick B. Rentschler II Professor of Sociology and Psychiatry at Vanderbilt University and director of its Center for Medicine, Health, and Society. He's the author of several books and a prominent expert on gun violence and mental illness. And his latest book just out is Dying of Whiteness: How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Metzl.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. And you're in Tennessee, and the story that the book tells of a man dying of hepatitis C, Trevor, he's a 41-year-old, and you asked him why he essentially has resisted Obamacare. He says, "I ain't no way I would ever support Obamacare or sign on for it. I would rather die." And then as you ask him further why he would choose death over the Affordable Care Act, his answer is, "We don't need any more government in our lives. And in any case, no way I want my tax dollars paying for Mexicans or welfare queens." And of course, he subsequently died. So in a way, though, Jonathan, I'm still left with a puzzlement. Have you been able to really figure out what exactly he means?
Sure. Well, really, what the quote you just gave really gets at the heart of the matter. At its core, the book looks at how the politics that were supposed to or claimed to make white America great again, if you look at kind of people's everyday lives and everyday practices, they end up making the lives of many working class white Americans harder, sicker, and in many cases shorter. And what I do in the book is I go across several main kind of issues. I talk to people about the Affordable Care Act and resistance to the Affordable Care Act. I talk to people about guns in places where it's very easy to get and carry a gun. I talk to people in places where basically there have been huge tax cuts that cut away funding for roads, bridges, and schools. And I find two main things. The first thing, as you suggest in that quote, is that people identify with core GOP policies, even when those policies have a very negative effect on their lives. And one of the main reasons I find as to why that is because of this sense that basically minorities or immigrants are taking away resources that are good for us, us being kind of working class white people. And what I found is that people in some instances, including the Trevor case, were really willing to die rather than to see resources go toward benefiting immigrants or minorities. And that was probably the more shocking part. But the other part is, of course, people kept supporting these policies even after the negative health consequences for them became more apparent. And so part of the story was this idea about what it meant to have a particular kind of privilege became quite literally and statistically, as I show in the book, fatal for a number of people.
But when you pointed out to him that next door in Kentucky, he would have been covered by Medicaid and he would have been able to get drugs that would have prolonged his life. I'm not sure that they would have cured him, but they certainly would have prolonged his life. And yet he supports politics of the state government there in Tennessee that refused Medicaid expansion. So what was his reasoning there?
Well, there are a couple things. First, as I point out in the book, it's in part of a history. In other words, Trevor wasn't just some person acting by himself, free from any context. And so there's a long history of kind of well-known histories of mistrust of the government in places in Tennessee. And there's particularly mistrust of social programs that seem to be equally distributing resources to people, everyone and the kind of mistrust of this sense of taking away something from us and giving it to them. And that was certainly something that played out across multiple different interviews that I did. And so certainly I think that history is important. There was a resistance to many government programs, from Social Security to desegregating hospitals to Medicare and Medicaid when those first hit. And I think those kind of comments fall in line with this history in the South of, you know, from the 1950s and 1960s on down, of being very mistrustful of government because it was destabilizing the social order. And I think that was something that certainly played out. But the other part of it is, you know, the GOP almost needed people to take positions like Trevor's. In other words, what I also talk about in the book is that had people in the South said, we like the Affordable Care Act because it pays for our medications and it pays for preventative care and it makes sure that there's much more universal health coverage than we have. If people would have said that, there's no way that the GOP could have enacted its policy of trying to block the Affordable Care Act. And so it needed people at the kind of lower income rungs to support policies that were bad for them. And so part of the point I make is that the success of GOP politics depends on poor white people making decisions that are bad for themselves in support of policies that help often kind of wealthy Americans and corporations. And so really it's that selflessness that I kind of wonder in the book, will this continue to be the GOP agenda, or will change happen? And if change happens, it really has to come from working class white Americans demanding better policies for themselves from their politicians.
And again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Metzl, who's a Frederick B. Rentschler, the second professor of sociology and psychiatry at Vanderbilt University and director of its Center for Medicine, Health and Society. He's the author of several books and a prominent expert on gun violence and mental illness. And his latest book just out is How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland. So in terms of the South, then, would this mentality that you're describing, the legacy of which you're writing about in your book, Dying of Whiteness, the Civil War, in effect, the South, these poor white blacksmiths, carpenters, farmers, etc., were fighting with the Confederacy essentially for the plantation owners' right to replace them with slaves. So there's always been this strange sort of disconnect in a way where they somehow can't look at the real sort of class structures that exist that encourage them to hate those below them, which then gives them some sense of status, but not to be critical of those above them who are essentially taking advantage of them.
That's a terrific question and a very smart question, and I really appreciate it. There's a long history. In other words, I think the politics of the American South, maybe up until Brexit, made no sense to people who didn't live in the United States, and they certainly don't make sense to a lot of people who don't live in the South. And so I think part of the issue is that certainly, as you say, there's a long history of people wondering, why is it that working class whites in the South don't align with working class communities of color? After the Civil War and in the years after that, you know, philosophers like W.E.B. Du Bois, for example, made the argument that there is something called, kind of a wage of whiteness, that white people in the South were being told that being white was a privilege and it was bestowed on them by upper class white Americans. And basically it's something special that's just yours. And it kept working class white populations from forming common cause with newly freed slaves. And part of the issue was, if that alliance would have happened across class lines, not across race lines, it would have been a much more powerful voice for betterment and change for working class people. So people kind of argue this idea of what it means to be white is what keeps white workers from forming bonds that would be beneficial. And certainly we see a lot of that in the present day. I think what's particularly interesting in the present day is that these politics that were for a very long time located just in the South are now becoming national policy. So part of what I argue is that I think kind of liberal coastal America was kind of tacitly okay with this dynamic happening when it was happening in Mississippi or Alabama or Tennessee, where I live. But now the Trump administration is taking these local state-level policies that have disastrous health effects for working-class people, and they're really turning them into national policies that are very beneficial for wealthy people but horrible for working-class people. So I think people now are recognizing this dynamic because it affects them a lot more than it probably did before.
Well, I suppose the modern iteration of what we're talking about here is the Tea Party. And, of course, the Tea Party was founded and funded by the Koch brothers, plutocrats. And they nevertheless...
And libertarians.
And libertarians, right. But they've nevertheless, just based on the Michael Cohen hearings where they were just sort of lashing out like attack dogs, they don't really have an answer, but they're always on the attack. So that gets to the sort of aggressive nature of it, which, of course, Trump exploits, the hate and division and the politics of white loss, nostalgia and resentment. So I think that's a new incarnation, is it not? When we did have, in the 1850s, we had the Know-Nothing movement, and to some extent, Trump has captured the new Know-Nothing constituency. But I don't know that we are in a position, perhaps going back to the Civil War, where we've actually had a leader who really does not want to bring America together. His entire political fate depends upon dividing us and stirring the pot of hatred.
Right. Well, I agree with a great deal of what you just said. I think that what I show in the book really does, and the research that I've done really does bore out a lot of those points. Again, if working class white communities ever said, maybe we support the GOP, but we also want funding for our roads or for our schools or better healthcare, the GOP platform would, as it's in its current iteration, would collapse, right? Because they need working class white people to pay with their lives, literally, in order to support the agenda. And so I think what's different now, in addition to just these widening gaps, not just ideological gaps, but financial gaps that are really, the divisions between rich and poor right now are incredibly dramatic by U.S. standards. And so I think part of what's happening now is that, the way that people are, the way that the GOP has successfully done this is to turn issues that are policy issues into identity issues, right? It's not just, you can't be pro or anti-gun from a policy standpoint or from a healthcare standpoint, same thing with the Affordable Care Act, et cetera, on down. It's really an identity that to be a Republican, you are pro-gun because that's your identity. And so I think they've been very successful. And these have always been a kind of stream of American politics, but I think also what we've been seeing since, as you say, the Tea Party really came into being with the Obama presidency starting around, 2008, 2009, that these fringe positions are now becoming mainstream positions. And that's where I think the real risk lies.
So, Jonathan Metzl, since you're a psychiatrist, what's your sense of why it is that there is the demographic facts that you brought out through the research, and the statistics are quite available? We heard some time back that the life expectancy amongst white Americans was going down, and that was a bit of an alarming. Now we've heard a lot about how the opioid epidemic is also striking in the heartland that you write about. And now you've done research to indicate that those states that rejected Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act, people are dying like Trevor. Gun deaths are also on the rise. And you mentioned the lack of infrastructure as well as a contributor. So those are all of the kind of combined effects of this sort of boiling resentment that exists in the middle and south of this country. But I still have a problem understanding the connection to religion, because this is also where the fundamentalist and evangelical churches are extremely strong. How do they get around, through mental gymnastics, get around the idea that the prophet Jesus actually ministered to the poor, encouraged love, not hate, etc. He didn't have an assault rifle. He didn't hate gays, etc., etc. Is that an element in sort of also this kind of mind warp that I'm wrestling with?
Well, I love that question because there's so much in it. And I would just want to say kind of all of the above in a particular way. Just to start with your point about the data that I found was pretty remarkable that in a way, the state level health effects of, rejecting the Affordable Care Act and not expanding Medicaid or of allowing everybody to buy and carry a gun or of cutting away, tax cuts that cut away people's roads and bridges, that led to shortened lifespans. And it didn't just lead to shortened lifespans for immigrants or minorities. It actually led to shortened lifespans also for white Americans, for working class white Americans. And across the book, I find that actually it wasn't just poor white Americans that suffered, that the aggregate life expectancy dropped between 2 and 3 weeks for white Americans, regardless of socioeconomic class. And part of why that is because when you have a failing infrastructure in a state, it's like secondhand smoke. It silently affects everybody's health. And so part of the issue is that the data story, I know you also were asking about psychiatry and religion, but I want to emphasize that the data story tells that these policies function like health hazards, right? And invisibly so. And so that's a pretty remarkable statistic when you see that a country as wealthy as ours with as much money as ours is promoting policies that are shortening dominant group lifespans. That should be a wake-up moment, but I don't think we're there yet. In terms of psychiatry and religion, I mean, I certainly look at this in part through the psychiatric lens. I try not, as much as I can, I try to take people at face value. I'm not trying to judge them or analyze them or diagnose them because I didn't really feel like that was my role. But I did think that there was many, many themes of self-sacrifice in what I've heard, that basically people felt like they were putting their lives on the line for a bigger cause. And so certainly part of the kind of psychological frame around this was that this sense of kind of I'm part of something that's so important that I'm willing to do something that's obviously bad for my own health in support of this bigger ideology. And that certainly seemed to be something that was pretty pervasive in a lot of people that I talked to. And I think that's important to know. I mean, I think in myself, how many of my policy positions am I willing to die for? And I can't really think of that many. And so I think that was part of the story. And then I also think that there was just a level of, I don't want to use the word shame too loosely, but I think this sense of basically we're in this very despairing position and somebody like Trump is the one person who's speaking for our interests. And so certainly that was it. And, it's not a stretch to see how the religious, certainly evangelical groups and things like that are picking up that theme. But I agree with you. I mean, I don't really have an answer except to say that when you would think about religion, you would think about, taking care of the poor and things like that. And it's pretty shocking to see them embracing policies that do the opposite, not just for strangers, but also for people in their congregations.
Well, just in closing, though, you mentioned that the resentment in the South is often due to the sense that the political elite, as they call them, treat them as flyover country. Is there a political prescription here? Because one of the things that I learned about the last election was that the Trump supporters that are there, certainly in the heartland, they also like Bernie Sanders, and Trump was very careful not to go after Bernie Sanders, I think because he recognized there was a kind of crossover vote. Is it possible for the Democrats to come up with a political platform that is the opposite of Hillary Clinton talking about the deplorables?
That was the election seemed to me to be lost right at that moment in many ways. I would say that the Democrats have done very well over time, forging policies that help working class white populations. And And I don't think that that's selling out any of the ideologies that the Democrats stand for. But I do think that Democrats have given up on trying to, in some ways, craft messages that are successful. And part of the argument that I make in the book Dying of Whiteness is that it's not an affront to democratic principles as I understand them. That basically what I show is that policies that are terrible for working class white populations are also terrible for everyone else. And so the flip side of that would be populations that are good for working class white populations will also help everybody else. And I don't think that the Democrats should shy away from that. They've in a way given Trump such free rein in terms of talking about these issues to his quote unquote base. But at the end of the day, Bernie Sanders realized that if he could craft a message that people in those in the South and in working class communities would identify with, they might actually sign up. And I think that's a message across the board that the Democrats should keep in mind.
Well, Jonathan Mezel, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much.
Well, thank you again. And I've been speaking with Jonathan Mezel, who's the Frederick B. Rentschler II Professor of Sociology and Psychiatry at Vanderbilt University and Director of its Center for Medicine, Health and Society. He's the author of several books and a prominent expert on gun violence and mental illness. And his latest book just out is Dying of Whiteness, How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland. We're going to take a restation break and back with an update on the expanding number of investigations into Trump, his family, and his administration. Southern man, better keep your head. Don't forget what your good book says. Southern change from the combat band. Now your crosses are burning fast. Southern man. Police and thieves in the street. Oh yes, scaring the nation with their guns and ammunition. But the next generation will be. Hear me. All the crimes committed day by day. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Lawrence Douglas, who's a professor of law, jurisprudence, and social thought at Amherst College. His most recent book is The Right Wrong Man, John Demjanjuk, and The Last Great Nazi War Crimes Trial. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Douglas.
Always a pleasure to speak with you, Ian.
Well, thanks, Lawrence. And there's some interesting developments. Obviously, it's a full-time job following the Mueller inquiry and the various other tangential inquiries into Trump with the Southern District of New York and now the Congress weighing in. So it's even going to get more complicated. But a couple of things got my attention. I wanted to sort of get an update, you will, from you, Lawrence, about one of them, of course, is that Michael Cohen, apparently in his second appearance to before the House Intelligence Committee, has provided them with documentation that indicates that his testimony was accurate. And of course, you know, we all know that had he lied once in those several hours before the House Oversight Committee, he would have been in huge trouble. So he had every motive in the world to be truthful. But nevertheless, he did say that his testimony, the very testimony that got him in trouble and got him going to jail because he lied to Congress, his testimony to Congress was edited by White House lawyer Jay Sekulow and Abby Lowell, who's the attorney for Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner. So I would suggest, and let me get your opinion, surely Jay Sekulow and Abby Lowell are in trouble, aren't they? Aren't they in jeopardy?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. And as you point out, I mean, the material that he supplied in this closed-door sessions of the House Intelligence Committee, at the first level, it corroborates what he said last week, because as we all know, there were efforts on the part of basically every House member on the Intelligence Committee basically tried to discredit him. I mean, you had Mark Green of Tennessee basically screaming that Michael Cohen was a false witness. So one thing this material does is it corroborates his testimony if it needed any further corroboration. And the other thing it does, as you point out, is it suggests that Sokolow and Abby Lowell, that they're, you know, that they're also now legally exposed. And then as a third level, it kind of raises this issue about, you know, it's not like Michael Cohen was engaging in kind of rogue actions in lying to Congress in 2017. It now looks like, you know, this was all pretty carefully vetted by people who were very close to the president and very close to his closest advisors, namely his circle of inner family members, Ivanka and Jared Kushner.
But in terms of the law, he doesn't get a do-over, does he? The fact that he'd been convicted on that count of lying to Congress when it's now becomes clear that he was doing so at the behest of Donald Trump.
Well, no, I don't think he gets, I mean, it doesn't matter if you're doing it at the behest of somebody else. I mean, he was still lying. I mean, the one thing that is interesting is, and this is something we also learned in his testimony last week, is that he is continuing to cooperate with prosecutors in the Southern District of New York. That is, his cooperation hasn't ended. This is an ongoing matter because he's trying to secure what's called a Rule 35 motion, and that would be basically a post-sentence reduction. So he's already been sentenced. We know he's been sentenced for 3 years, but he's trying to get that reduced, and he's trying to do that through further cooperation with the Southern District of New York. So it is possible that, you know, through his continued cooperation, even though he can't walk back what he did in 2017, that the continued cooperation could help him.
And there's another development that I wanted to run by you, Lawrence Douglas, and that is that apparently under the rules of the independent counsel that Robert Mueller is operating on, that there is apparently a requirement that the Attorney General has to make public whether or not there was any efforts to curtail in any way Mueller's inquiry. In other words, if anybody said to him, no, you can't subpoena that person. And that might prove to be interesting if that is released, right? Is that...
Yes, it is very interesting. So, because, of course, one of the, you know, the big unanswered questions right now is how much of the Mueller report our new Attorney General Barr will permit to be released. And yet the law requires him, if he doesn't release the report, at least to release information about efforts to curtail the investigation. So it does, you know, at the very least, it creates a kind of a safety valve for information coming to the public. Again, not necessarily information about the substance of the report, but actually information about efforts to make sure that Mueller's investigation didn't go as far as it sought to.
And again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Douglas, who's a professor of law, jurisprudence, and social thought at Amherst College. His most recent book is The Right Wrong Man, John Demjanjuk and the Last Great Nazi War Crimes Trial. The other question, though, just in that context, Lawrence, is that is there something underway here with Barr? I always thought it was a bit strange that he auditioned for the job in the way that Whitaker did with that 19-page unsolicited memo. He's a very conservative Republican, and so, by the way, is the special counsel, Robert Mueller. Is it possible that there's some effort underway to limit the damage to the GOP, to the GOP brand? In other words, if it turns out, as it seems to be the case, that Trump is both a criminal and a traitor, and short of being nailed as a traitor, I think it'll be pretty well established that his business practices over the years have been criminal, and he's never expected to win the White House, as we know from Cohen's testimony. He kept saying that the campaign was the greatest infomercial in the world, and he would it would do wonders for the Trump brand. But then he won, and now he's in the world's biggest goldfish bowl, and never been subject to the kind of scrutiny he's under now. So my sense is that if I were a Republican establishment figure, I'd be worried that my brand is going to be wrecked for decades, and I'd be perfectly happy to hang Trump out to dry.
Yes, I mean, even though that theory is one which has one would think that it had a lot of supporters, and yet we've seen the incredible absence of backbone of Republicans in the House and the Senate, and we keep anticipating that at some point the support for Trump will just kind of peel away. And, it's really hard to speculate about what, if and when that would happen. I mean, one thing I would say, though, is I'd much rather have William Barr, conservative as he may be, I'd much rather him overseeing the Mueller investigation than having Matthew Whitaker. I mean, Whitaker really seemed a little bit more like a hack and someone who really doesn't have remotely the kind of legal profile that a William Barr does. And, call me naive, but I do think that he does have, some kind of deep residual and vestigial dedication to the rule of law. And he's not going to simply let a corrupt president run roughshod over it.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes then, the former head of the CIA, John Brennan, was on MSNBC, Lawrence O'Donnell, and he said that I wouldn't be surprised, for example, this week on Friday, not knowing anything about it, but Friday is the day the grand jury indictments will come down. So do you think that there'll be some bombshells dropped on Friday?
Again, the pronostications, I think, are always a little bit tricky to make. So I don't know if it's Friday. I don't know if it's a month from now. The question is, will there be indictments coming down? I think it's probably safe to say there will be. Will these indictments include people that are very close to Trump, that is members of his family, such as Donald Jr. and Jared Kushner? I think, a betting person could certainly say yes. So, I think the timeline is a little less critical than the substance of what's going to come out, which I do expect to be a bombshell.
Well, Brennan did go on to say, though, if anybody from the Trump family, extended family, is going to be indicted, it would be the final act of Mueller's investigation. So he's saying that probably not Friday, Jared or Ivanka or
right.
Don Jr., because when that happens, Trump's going to go nuts and shut the whole thing down.
That's true. Right.
Talk about strange times in which we live. It's just extraordinary, isn't it, that we are in a position now where we're openly speculating on whether the President of the United States is both a criminal and a traitor.
Well, it is, yes. I mean, it's astonishing. I mean, they're just kind of the inventory of crimes that basically emerge from, it's not as if it's new material, but that emerged from the testimony last week from Cohen. I mean, a lot of the focus was on hush money and, campaign finance fraud, but really it's about private enrichment, it's collusion, it's money laundering. I mean, there's an entire list of basically felonious conduct which being, attributed to the President of the United States. It's astonishing.
Well, Lawrence Douglas, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure again, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Douglas, who's a professor of law, jurisprudence, and social thought at Amherst College. His most recent book is The Right Wrong Man, John Demjanjuk, and The Last Great Nazi War Crimes Trial. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. A lady dressed in white with a man she loves.